perfection. Oh Lord, it's been a long, long way to go. All you need is a bit of reflection. Just might seem like changing direction right now. Don't go around taking up no collection. On our way down, there's nobody left to crown. What if politicians were all good guys? Oh Lord, don't we wish they were? Wouldn't it be so dependent? God, so Lord, make us all feel like dependent sometimes. If we want freedom, we've got to amend it. On our way down, there's nobody left to cry. Be it ever so humble, there's no place like home. Home, home on the range, with the fear and the antidote. We're seldom heard an encouraging word, and our leaders do nothing all day.
That's a great political commentary in itself from the great folk singer, percussive guitarist, composer, and activist Richie Havens, with a title track from his album, Nobody Left to Crown, that was released in 2008. Richard Pierce Havens died this very day last year. He was 72 years old. He had toured for more than 30 years and produced 30 albums, and his music continues to have extraordinary impact and meaning long after he's gone. That will be the case. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, April the 22nd, and today we are going to have a political reality check, and it's an opportune moment because midterm elections are upon us, and the political tempo has quickened, and with it, claims and counterclaims about who did or can do what to improve the quality of life for all Americans. All 435 seats in the U.S. House of Representatives and 33 U.S. Senate seats are up for grabs, and there are contests for in 46 state and 4 territorial legislatures, 36 governorships, and 28 key mayoral slots. And it's going to be a bruising battle between, as we discussed, the bipolar nature of the United States political scene, with the two dominant parties vying for control. And of course now, their political fortunes are tied to constituencies that they routinely have ignored. Well, we will have our guest shortly with us. Attorney at War, Alton Maddox, as he's called, the people's self-appointed attorney general, who has in his career always put himself at the service of the community, and more often, I should say most often, pro bono, has defended the defenseless. He's going to be with us today, and we'll be talking about how things look from the front lines. all these wonderful concepts. You know, the media gets into the theatrics of it, but seldom the reality, the raw reality, the relationship between all of that pomp and circumstance and all that choreography that goes on, and what is the relationship between that and the raw truth of everyday life for the vast majority. Let them know, please, to call 888-874-4888. We're having a little connection issue, but he will be here with us very shortly. In the meantime, I can talk about this concept. What is the relationship between this dance that happens every so often? They'll be having the midterm dance, and now it's going to be really important that the community engage. We heard that message from President Obama. The job, he said, at the National Action Network's 16th annual convention, the job is to get out there and vote. For what? For whom? You know, what is the purpose of it? And everybody comes to the realization now that your vote is really important. And the effort is to persuade you that despite what you have been experiencing in your everyday life, which is, of course, the flip side of public policy, you know, the impact of the things that they do down there in Washington and in the state legislatures and in the city council and in other forms of government, those things have direct impact on your daily life, but that's not where they are. They're not tuned into that. They're tuned into just making the call to action, and now they implore you on the basis of your American consciousness, your American identity. You are a participant in the great process of democracy, so you have to come out there and exercise the vote, even though there is very little relationship between this vote and my interests, this vote and my benefit, this vote and the aggregate benefit to society. It's a game. And more people are fed up of this game. More and more people are really detesting this notion of being essentially punked. You know, you had a good idea about voting. You had a consciousness about voting and a conscientiousness about voting. But it turns into a kind of perverse trick, because your vote has nothing to do with your benefit. Alton Maddox joins us now. Hello, Alton.
How are you doing, Eutrice?
Fine, thank you.
Okay,
so
thanks for the invitation.
We'll take get a sense of what it looks like on the front lines today. As you know, the Supreme Court, we could start there, has ruled that the state of Michigan is protected in deciding that it does not have to observe affirmative action guidelines in admissions to state universities. What's your reaction to that?
Well, my reaction is simply this. First, I think we need to go back and define the Emancipation Proclamation. And I think we should conclude from that that because it was a fraudulent document, it is not synonymous with freedom. That's first of all. Secondly, I think there has to be an acknowledgement that this Emancipation Proclamation, at best, was not a divorce, and it was only a separation, and it provided no support payments. Which really run counter to the severance of any relationship because it's really unknown, even in bankruptcy or any other relationship that you have. There has to be some type of buyout provision in order to make sure that nobody is particularly injured. So I think that that is a very important notion before we even get into those, to this claim of affirmative action. And then I think what is also important for us to really is to reexamine the sequential order of the U.S. Constitution and particularly the Reconstruction Amendments. And while some may argue that the 13th Amendment brought up an end to slavery, it did not provide any basis for citizenship. And to the extent that it did not provide any basis for citizenship, the 14th Amendment is really out of order, because the only way that you can really become a citizen is to have the right to vote. And the right to vote has to have a triggering mechanism attached to it. And so, you know, when all of this was being done, it was being done out of order, and it has not been corrected to this very moment. The same way that the original Constitution itself had flaws, and these flaws are still being challenged. For example, the issue of what is xenophobic and the arguments about immigrant rights. It's still an issue that was grounded in the original Constitution, and it's still an issue that affects people today. I mean, the issue of women's rights, misogynists, that's something that was centered in the U.S. Constitution, and it's an issue that's still dealing with affecting people today. The whole question of right to work and whether the so-called founding father was ergophobic or not is also another issue that we're dealing with. So, you know, what we are saying is the original document was flawed, and then the Reconstruction Amendment was also flawed, and therefore we are caught in a vicious cycle.
Well, none other than former Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens is now, in his new book, Six Amendments, How and Why We Should Change the Constitution, is now calling for amendment of the Constitution, which not too long ago, and in fact still is, viewed as a kind of heresy. Mm-hmm. You're not supposed to in any way fiddle with the Constitution. It is like the God's word, made manifest.
Yeah, and the problem is that you still have these long-standing, continuing problems, which should have been resolved by now. Is the Constitution really purported to be what it claimed to have been? The mere fact that we are still caught up in arguing affirmative action and arguing women's rights and the right to choose and all of these other issues over 200-something years after the Constitution was written, is prima facie proof there's a flawed document, and that it makes no sense for us to continue to engage in all this litigation going back and forward on a document that is absolutely flawed ab initio. And so that's what we are caught up with now. And really some real level heads have to come to the table who really understand these issues. And not too much of that is going to come out of the black community, because the so-called black selected officials have the foggiest notion of what is the meaning of the U.S. Constitution in the first place. You know, it's like following a coach of basketball, and he don't even know who the basketball rules are. I mean, it's absolutely crazy for us to be getting behind people who don't even know the rules of the game. And that's what we find ourselves. We have allowed ourselves to get caught up behind some buffoons, and it's only sending all of us to prison because the idea that if you follow a buffoon or a Judas goat, then all of you are fools. And so when you get ready to go to court and argue for your innocence, ain't nobody gonna believe you because the only thing they know you were following a buffoon. And you have very low standards. And so any time that you can put a buffoon out there and a cartoon as a rat And everybody obviously cannot refute the fact that he is not a rat, and yet you follow him. It means that you, all of you, should be in prison, and in prison guards with an inmate number attached to you. I mean, this is just very simple logic. It don't take a rocket scientist to figure this out, and other people have figured out, and that's the reason why other people send us to prison, and that's also the reason why, in no case I ever tried you, Trees, except one, and I was forced to do this because of the affirmative defense in a murder prosecution I had to try to use to say this one particular client. I've never put a black person on the witness stand, never, because black people have a bad reputation. And the fact that you're on the witness stand, or the fact that you're trying to have an alibi witness to come in and give you an alibi, is prima facie proof of your guilt. Because we have allowed our reputation to be so soared that it affected the entire race. You know, it ain't nothing cute anymore, because when you go to these prisons, ain't nothing but us. And they are there because we have allowed our reputation to be lowered to a point where we belong in prison.
Well, I want to kind of tack onto that and talk about a case that is symbolic of what it is you're talking about, and that's Reuben Hurricane Carter's case.
Absolutely.
Reuben Hurricane Carter died in his sleep at age 76 this uh-huh. past weekend. And, you know, I hate these kinds of stories where, in the aftermath of what is clearly an intolerable injustice, heaped on top of intolerable injustice. You know, now you get all the flowery speeches and you get all the, you know, the accolades and what a noble person he was and, you know, how he dealt with being imprisoned falsely for almost 20 years, and what a gracious person he was despite that, all that long-suffering, you know, noble thing. He was all of that, sure, but I am disgusted by these kinds of stories because they're way too prevalent in our consciousness. We encounter this way too often. What does Reuben Hurricane Carter's case suggest? What should it suggest to us?
Well, you know, Utrecht, you and I are so wide, you know, and people would not know. You know, you and I, we very seldom talk. And when we do talk, it makes it easy for me to have a conversation with you because we basically have the same instincts and the same interests. And so it's easy to talk to you because most of the things that you raise, I've already prepared. I'm sitting here right now writing an article on you, on Reuben Hurricane Carter, all right, at this very moment. And it's very interesting, and I hope that a lot of people get a chance to really read, because the story of Reuben Hurricane Carter is really symptomatic of the problem that all of us have suffered as a people. And what is real interesting about that story, Utrecht, and this is the reason why they should have law libraries in the black community instead of public libraries, you know, and that's a real tragedy, because what we really need are legal historians, people who can really trace the legal history. And, you know, and I'm trying to argue with Negroes right now, supposed to be supportive of mine, you know, why we need to spend money on certain things that they are resisting. These people are supposed to be progressive, and they make progressivism into a joke, you know, in terms of really what that word really means. But this is why I'm saying this. I've looked at several cases, and I've looked at the doctrine of states' rights, and I looked at the prison industrial complex. And what you get out of this is that each state essentially has the same laws. And basically what these laws say in the title of my article is judges without erasures. In other words, there are no erasers to these pencils that they give judges. And what these judges do, they sit there and they get these transcripts with injustices just, I mean, popping off the page. and there's no way in the world you can miss these injustices. And yet, the judges don't have no erasure to take these injustices off the books. And so, it's a whole process. I mean, people have not studied why so many people are behind bars and why it takes the judicial system sometimes 20 and 25 and 30 years to make a correction in an obvious and odious error. And that is because the laws in every state, and I'm citing now Article 470 of the New York Criminal Procedure Law, which is the law in New York. But other states have very similar laws, which basically says that appellate judges can rewrite the facts, but they can't correct the facts. All right? They can't, in other words, they can't correct an injustice. And that's right there in the statute. We're not even reading the laws, and most of us are not reading the laws because the laws are not in our community. But the laws say in New York that a judge can review a case but cannot erase any injustices and therefore correct an unlawful conviction. And so this is what happened with Reuben Hurricane Carter. And what was interesting is that I heard an interview of him the last few days, and he was saying in that interview that when he got convicted of this of crime, murder, that he just knew or had faith that the judges upstairs would read the transcript and say, wait a minute, this man has been wrongfully convicted. Because it was so obvious, according to Reuben Hurricane Carter, that this is exactly what happened. He was astounded to find that it would take him 22 decades before there could be any corrections. And what happened was, in the meantime, the appellate courts in New Jersey, as well as the New Jersey Supreme Court, did not have any razors in order to correct the condition. And so what we find in the black community is that a governor of a state is responsible for all of this, and these governors have a list of people who are not to be released. And so when the appellate judges get this list, they see People versus Reuben Hurricane Carter on it, and they just throw that case to the wolves. They see People versus Mumia Abu-Jamal on the list, and they just forget about making any corrections in those cases at all. And this may sound strange to some people who are naive, but this is exactly what is happening. Because no way in the world that you can be in court and look at a transcript and not see that, hey, there's something afoul in this case. The same thing happened with the Central Park 7. You had all those defendants who went upstairs on appeal, and out of all of the judges that got a chance to review the case, only one judge, and he was out of Staten Island, only one judge out of the whole shebang said, wait a minute, I see something wrong here. The only problem is he was outnumbered. So, you know, when they got ready to count up the votes, you know, they affirmed the conviction in this one case, and that was the case of Yusuf Salam. But in every other case, all of the judges were unanimous that these boys was guilty and they should spend the rest of their days behind bars. And had it not been for this one young man coming forward and admitting to guilt, they would still be doing time today. And they still haven't been compensated.
Nor has there been any further investigation as to prosecutorial misconduct.
Absolutely.
And investigators and detectives and police misconduct or judicial misconduct.
Absolutely. There's been none of that. In fact, you know, since I was involved in the case, and since my client was the only one who was able to get out of it, you know, as a result of it, the whole legal system turned on me. They were mad because I was able to successfully defend this young man. That's what we're dealing with here. Any time that you can have any real success in the legal system and it goes against the police or any other law enforcement agency, you're doomed yourself. So I'm paying for this myself as you and I talk. I mean, I haven't been disbarred, but I have been barred from all courtrooms in the United States.
Well, I want to shift gears a bit. I'm going down a list of things that I want to cover with you today, and that concerns the annual ritual of the National Urban League producing its predictable State of Black America report. And it usually says the same thing. It's been saying the same thing for as long as they've been putting it out. The president and CEO of the National Urban League is then seen at the National Action Network's 16th annual convention. And everybody's all huggy-huggy. There's
Absolutely.
The president, who is huggy, with Marc Morial, the National Urban League's president and CEO, and Reverend Alfred Sharpton. They're all buddies. So it seems as if there has been a secret convention somewhere that we now have new designated hitters, new designated black leaders. Am I reading it right or wrong?
You're absolutely reading it absolutely correct. And, you know, obviously this is a subject that I know a lot about. And so I'm not speaking off the cuff when I say this. And I know a lot about it because it doesn't violate the attorney-client privilege. What it does is buttress the work product privilege. You see, when you go to represent a client tells you certain things, that's protected by the attorney-client privilege. And you know, I'm down in history as protecting that to the hilt. But on the other hand, there's the work product privilege in which you should go out and investigate your client because you know you could make some tactical errors during the course of the trial if you didn't know the background of your client because the other side is certainly going to investigate it. And so you know what you have here. In terms of Reverend Sharpton, that it goes way beyond the idea of him being a snitch. He just loved white supremacists. I mean, that's just the bottom line. He loved people who hate his race and who hate him. Now, that may be a psychological problem. I will confess that I'm not a psych, a shrink, and I can't explain to you why. But, you know, anytime you're in a situation where your best friends are Ed Koch, Alphonse D'Amato, Reverend Jerry Falwell, Donald Trump. There's something seriously wrong. I mean, something seriously wrong. And so what I'm saying is it makes it easier for birds of a feather to flock together. It makes it easy for him to hook up with Marc Morial of the National Urban League and other outfits because this is basically who he is. And, you know, and the Urban League is basically an organization that talks about rights without remedies. I mean, so, you know, it's like, okay, these are your rights, but you have no remedies. And so, you know, and like you said before, it may be good reading for a minute, but after you read the reports for 2 or 3 years, I mean, you know, it gets repetitious and it becomes the exact same thing. And you can go back to the time that it was formed in the early 1900s, maybe 1912, 13, whatever, and you know you'll see this trend.
Well, more than anybody I know, you will know about Reverend Sharpton. You uh-huh. defended him, as a matter of fact. One can safely say that had it not been for your successful defense of him on a federal indictment of 62, I believe, was it? 62 counts. 67 counts. He would probably not be around, walking around and doing the things that he's doing. The story that broke, saying that he was an informant for the FBI and basically that it was about breaking the stranglehold of the mafia in New York, There was a story that started emerging in the early to mid-1980s, as I recall it, in Brooklyn among activists.
Right.
What do you know about this? These contentions about Reverend Alfred Sharpton being an informant, or how did you come to know about this?
Well, I came to know about that particular claim in June of 1987. And I really believe it probably surfaced after Howard Beach. And, you know, what was interesting about it, and I think this is what something that you've talked about, and I don't think nobody picked up on this yet. But the argument was that Reverend Sharpton was a real problem, and he had to be dealt with. And, you know, what I did know at that particular time in June 1987, the most visible problem seemed to have been Roy Ennis. I mean, rather than Reverend Sharpton. So, you know, obviously,
Roy Ennis being the executive director of the Congress of Racial Equality.
Right, right. And so, when it was talked about Reverend Sharpton being a real problem, I just asked, well, what about Roy? And, you know, because Roy was really getting more headlines at that time and was more of a seemingly a traitor than anybody else. And so, you know, people say, well, no, we're not dealing with Roy Ennis right now. We're dealing with Sharpton. And I said, you know, well, you know, the lawyer in me say that we got a couple problems here. One, we are dealing with ex post facto law because I don't know what law among this group Sharpton violated. Because the last time I checked, y'all didn't enact or write any laws. We don't have a code of ethics here in the black community. And I say the second issue seems to me as a lawyer, the question of selective prosecution. And I said, really, the bottom line is while Sharpton may be a problem, but I really think that we need to make ourselves accountable to each other first and to our communities. I think that should be our first step in the whole process. And then we deal with Sharpton and those later. And so, you know, we had a second meeting and people said, well, no, I think we got to deal with Sharpton now. And I said, well, I just won't be coming to any more meetings because I really think that you need a code of ethics first. I think that's what happened in other communities. You know, I think that's what happened when people got off the Mayflower, coming over here. They drafted a code. And I really can't understand why history is not repeating itself. And so, you know, I bowed out of it. Now, you know, the bottom line was one of the persons who really knew Reverend Sharpton very well was Louis Clayton Jones. And, you know, and Clayton basically took a no-nonsense approach to dealing with people. And even after we had the trial in Manhattan of the 67 counts, I mean, Clayton stood in a packed audience at Bethany Baptist Church and told Reverend Sharpton point blank, well, you know, I know you got offered these charges, Al, but you're guilty as charged. You know, you're guilty as charged, you know, and that's what you need to deal with. The fact I know you did all these things because I was the one that helped save you from the mafia. So I know you deal with the mob. You know, I mean, you had a history of dealing with the mob. You wouldn't be around here now if I hadn't gone out there and tried to save you. And so, you know, what I'm saying is, what is interesting about Reverend Sharpton is that he keep, turn around and for somehow or another keep getting baths, and it seems to clean him off for a minute. And, you know, and then he goes back and get another bath, and it gets cleaned off again. But I think the reality of it is that Reverend Sharpton is a serial offender. You know, he has no disregard for our community at all. And he's committed to white supremacists. Among those that I just talked about with Jerry Falwell, for example. He was down there at Liberty University in Virginia with Jerry Falwell. I mean, and at the same time, Jerry Falwell was talking about Dr. King like he was a dog. So, you know, I don't know where do our insult level kicks in.
But how then, how did this surface, I should ask you, did this surface with the Brawley case where he was quite intimate with the case and advocating on behalf, at least at one time, of Tawana Brawley. Did that surface? Was that a factor in that case?
No, that wasn't a factor then, because Tawana had not been raped until November of 87, and this was June of 87. So this was preceding that, you know. And the bottom line is from my perspective, is that he had a whole history of doing these kinds of things, you know, even with Asada Secure and other people. And, you know, he had a very bad reputation, you know, as a result of it. He just never changed. And everything he got in, you know, he just saw the atmosphere. You know, that we were dealing with. I mean, that's the kind of man he is. And for us as a people, you know, to continue to allow him to be portrayed as our leader is only taking us all out. Because, you know, you know better than your leader. And if you will allow somebody to act like they are our leader, then everybody else is going to figure out we all are the same ilk. And they're going to take the same move against all of us. And so, you know, in a very ironic way, Reverend Sharpton is sending more black boys and men to prison than any other source. And the reason why he's doing it, because of who he is.
You have to explain.
What I'm saying is, one, I'm sure that there are a lot of people that he has snitched on. I'm sure that, you know, I know some of them myself, you know, who were very prominent. He started snitching with Small Fries, and then he started eventually going into a lot of people who had other mishaps, who were well entrenched financially. But yeah, something that really happened there. I'm giving an example. You know, and I'm only saying this is the first time, Utrice. I was a very good friend of Chukwuemeka Lumumba. And as a matter of fact, when Chukwuemeka came to New York,
Chukwuemeka Lumumba, I should say, is a recently deceased mayor of Jackson.
Right. Right. And so, when he first came here, you know, he was representing the Black Liberation Army, was representing New African People's Organization, you know, Republic of New Africa, and some other groups. And so, you know, and he was being barred from New York, and I picked up his calls, represented him, and got him allowed to practice law. He a pro hoc vici. And so, you know, in earlier days, they were concerned about Sharpton, you know, being a snitch for the federal government and trying to locate Asada Secure. And I don't know if you know Ahmed Obafemi,
sure.
But Ahmed, you know, talked a lot about this, and Ahmed and Chukwuemeka were very close in the whole bit. And I remember when Chukwuemeka won down in Jackson, Mississippi, to become the mayor, I was virtually the only person down in Jackson standing with him. Now, he became very popular among a lot of people later, but on that particular night, I was essentially the only person that was standing with Chukwuemeka. And what is interesting to me is that at some point, Reverend Sharpton wiggled his way into Chukwuemeka's bosom, so to speak. And the next thing that I knew, Chukwuemeka was dead. And, you know, so I'm just saying that I really cannot vouch for this man under any circumstances now. And he's a wild card. And, you know, and this is what we have to deal with until we develop a code of ethics and deal with him appropriately.
I'm still a couple of sentences back there where you said that after bosom, I heard dead. What is the inference?
Well, the inference is I don't know why Chukwuemeka was dealing with him. All right, that's the inference I'm making. I don't know what Sharpton did, but I don't know why Chukwuemeka, after all that he has said about Sharpton and all that we knew about Sharpton, why he would be become seemingly bosom buddies with Sharpton. And my point is that at some point right after that, Chuck Woody's dead under very suspicious circumstances. I mean, people were raising by autopsy reports and all of these kinds of things. So that's what I'm saying. But my point is, I don't know how Chuck Woody went from knowing all of these things about Sharpton and making all of these commitments and pledges that he would not get involved with this man. And then in his last days, he's right there with him. And the end result of it is Chuck Woody is dead now.
I want to talk about you and your particular case. I recently interviewed Stanley Cohen. I know you know who he is. He's an attorney with some of the most contentious and reviled clients, people who really hate his clients and hate him because of his representation of certain clients. He said in the interview, I asked him, how does he deal with it? And he said in the interview, and I asked him specifically, he talked about you, as a matter of fact. He said, people like him and you expect that there would be great retaliation and a great deal of hardship because of what you do, but you are prepared to do it. Uh-huh. I want to ask about your status in this case, which I think it should be a major concern as to why it is. This is such a flagrant violation of law that an attorney general, a state attorney general, could essentially request an entire state legislature to bar you from the practice of law, not only in New York State, but even outside of New York State, and that the legislature would do it. You were not in any way, you still have not been the subject of a complaint. You have not been brought before the bar. You have no convictions or any complaint standing against you by any clients, and yet this stands. So I have to ask, what has the son of the governor who in 1985 said there's no such thing as the mafia? What is he doing? What has happened with your case?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. And, you know, there is possibly a detailed answer to some, and maybe I can abbreviate it for others. But, you know, when you get out here and you start poking around like I was in so many different kinds of cases, you know, you find so many different interests, you know. So it's like you deal with the Central Park 7, and you happen to be the only person to walk out of the Central Park 7, you know, which suggests that, well, maybe something was wrong with the case. Well, then you become an object of a person like Robert Morgenthau, you know, just in terms of that matter. Now, the thing about Abrams is that, and a lot of people don't know this, but I made a motion for Judge Joan Carey, and I said, look, I like to call Abrams and Dinkins to the witness stand.
Now, Robert Abrams was the state attorney general at the time of the Brawley case.
Right, at the time of the Brawley case. And so, you know, at that particular time, what lawyers do, you want to prepare a witness list, you know, and decide later whether you may need some of these witnesses or not, you know. So, you know, so I made a motion that Abrams, despite the fact that he was a New York State Attorney General, should be called to the witness stand because I had reason to believe and could prove that he was a foot soldier for the mob. And I also said that Dave Dinkins was a foot soldier for the mob. And Judge Carey, interestingly enough, granted my motion. And so here you have me possibly cross-examining Abrams or examining Abrams as to their involvement in the mob. And now, on the other hand, you have a situation where when you deal with Don King, that becomes another issue, because what was telling is that Reverend Sharpton called me on the date that he was about to be arrested and said that he had just gotten a phone call from Jack Newfield. Now, Jack Newfield was a noted journalist in New York City, and he had a real thing on against Don King. I mean, with no question about it. And, you know, there was another lawyer, Bob Aaron, who was also a boxing promoter. And a lot of people really wanted Bob Aaron instead of Don King. And so when Sharpton called me that morning and said, I just got a call from Jack Newfield, and Jack said that the police is on their way over here to pick me up. Now, that may have not meant too much to Sharpton, but for me, my antenna immediately went up because a grand jury proceedings will be secret. And the only way that Newfield would know anything about Sharpton's case was that Newfield had inside information. And so obviously, Newfield entry being Don King, you know, the whole case really, and from Newfield's point of view, centered around Don King. And so, you know, what I'm saying is that it got to the point where I had my finger in too many holes. I mean, that's really the bottom line. And I was making these claims and was capable of winning these claims. And so, you know, at some point, you know, the New York legislature, and I have a letter here from them to Abrams, and the letter said, hey, you got to take action against this man. You know, he can't go around and do the things that he's doing. Something got to be done. And so you're absolutely right. That's called a bill of attainder, which is totally and facially unconstitutional. But it happened. And the proof is that I insisted at my disciplinary hearing that it had to be public and not private. And this happened to be the only disciplinary hearing in the history of New York State that was public. It wasn't private. And I wanted people to see that there was no complaining witness against me. There was no client. You know, there was no introduction of a felony record. There was none of this. So, you know, I mean, to this day, anybody can go back and look at that record and say, wait a minute, why isn't there a complaining witness here? How do you find somebody guilty and there's no complaining witness? Who is a client? I mean, the only complaining witness here is a shadow legislature, you know, who has his own problem with Maddox, but a legislature can't take action against an attorney. You know, I mean, that's not the way the process works. In order to be unethical, you have to have a client who you have breached their ethical relationship between you and that client. That's the only way you can do it. If you go in there and you can't find that client, and there is no client, and I can ask anybody to go to the appellate division and ask them to read the record, and you won't find a client, that, and you were sitting there, most people were sitting there, and they didn't hear from any client, then, you know, you're absolutely right that something is definitely awry and something went astray.
Well, as we come to the close, I wanted to ask you about the Democratic Party ramping up its efforts via Sharpton, via Marc Morial, via the president, and any number of other Democratic Party enthusiasts, that the African-American community needs to respond affirmatively and soon when these midterm elections are had. What are your feelings about that?
Well, you know, I think the big thing, you know, Retrieve, obviously, you know, I'm so caught up in really trying to get a Freedom Party started, a third party, really, you know, that you know, I mean, this other stuff, you know, it sometimes escapes me. But, you know, what is interesting here is that you hear issues now like Cuomo approval rating is slipping, and it may be a possibility that the Working Family Party get involved. Who knows where that might take people. I mean, so, you know, what my point is that we have to have a horse in the race, you know, in order to get into the winner's circle. We have to have a horse in the race. And even if we can't win the race, we have to leverage our influence and our votes to an extent that we can affect some other matters that are relevant to us as a community. You know, and I think the real problem that I have, it seems like I'm the only person who's willing to be an investor in this effort. I mean, there are some people who are donors, you know, and then there are some other people who are many other people who are social parasites, but they, you know, there are no investors. And so, you know, it gets back to this point that we're dealing with. What is interesting here is that we're talking about Al Sharpton, who has an MSNBC program and a satellite radio program, and he doesn't have to leave outer space in order to reach the community. You and I are talking out of space. I mean, we're not in space. I mean, we're out of space. And so what I'm saying is anybody with a ticket brain cell ought to realize how bad things are is in order that you and I can talk, have this credible conversation about the truth. We have to go out of space in order to carry this conversation on. And that's the real tragedy, you know, beyond everything else. And my second point is that someone like you who providing this service, I mean, anybody that listen to this should readily, you know, say, well, you know what, I'm going to drop a dime on you, Treece, and hope that this can continue. I'm going to drop a dime on her to hope that I get more information to teach me how to think myself about the conditions that are affecting us. This is what really bothers me, is that we're not making sure that a Utrecht lead or an Alton Maddox or other people of that ilk can really stay around.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. I'm sure you're hearing some noise in the background. There is a stubborn tree that somebody is trying to cut down, and this is probably the 20th attempt to do so.
Okay.
And so far, the tree is winning. The tree has been winning. So I want to thank you
well,
so much, Alton.
Well, right now, the tree is like you and I. We're also continue
still
to win.
Standing. Despite the conspiracy, we still
absolutely,
stand.
Despite the conspiracy, we continue to win.
Well, thank you so much, Alton, for being with us today. I want to talk with you about doing a legal clinic at some point in the future, soon, I hope.
I really do, because I do have some real serious notions that I'm trying to get out there, and I think will really be very beneficial to us as a community.
How do people get to find out about the Freedom Party?
Well, right now, the best way to deal with that is by my own website. You know, we've had other problems getting a concrete website going on, but all the information right now is on my website, which is www.reinstatealtonmaddox.net. www.reinstatealtonmaddox.net. The information is there. We just got to get a better structured website in order to convey it to our people.
Thank you once again for being with us today and for sharing your thoughts with us, Alton. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Treece.
Right. Well, that brings us to the end of the program. I hope you learned something. Something started percolating in your brain. And, of course, tomorrow we will have a wonderful program for you again. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Infectious Myth with David Crow. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com, on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrecht Lead. And it's a pleasure and a privilege to be in your company. Thank you so much for being with me today.